Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is award-winning journalist Kenneth Miller, and we're continuing our conversation about his book, Mapping the Darkness, The Visionary Scientists Who Unlocked the Mysteries of Sleep. Ken, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Now, we ended the last conversation about Mammoth Cave and Nathaniel Kleitman. What were the upshots of that cave experiment? One of the weird things is they became stars in doing that. I mean, they became famous. Reporters were waiting for them when they came out.
Yeah, it's true. So Nathaniel Kleitman, just to remind listeners, was the founder of modern sleep science, who launched the first dedicated sleep lab at the University of Chicago in 1925. In 1938, he goes on this expedition to Mammoth Cave to try to rearrange his sleep-wake cycles to a 28-hour cycle instead of the usual 24 hours. He and an assistant spent a month in Mammoth Cave and just trying to do this experiment where they're living in bunk beds, and just trying to rearrange their sleep-wake schedules, which it turned out the assistant, who was a young grad student, could do it. He was able to, his body temperature adjusted to his sleeping patterns, and he felt fine. Kleitman could never adjust to a 28-hour day. And so what is the scientific upshot of this? Not really clear, but the publicity upshot was something else entirely. So while Kleitman and his assistant are down there in Mammoth Cave, the press got wind of it. During the experiment, a guy from Associated Press came down and interviewed the two scientists and started writing articles about what they were doing down there. And it really just sort of lit a spark, and the public got really interested.
Well, it's really like a fascinating story.
Yeah, and so they were, and they're down there living in the depths of this cave, and they've got this little camp set up with little tables and machines to measure their body functions and stuff like that. But they're also doing things like listening in to the big boxing match that happened that year in 1938. They're getting cigarettes and newspapers and meals delivered from the Mammoth Cave Hotel. It was just this bizarre experiment. It really caught people's imaginations, made front pages all across the country. And when they came out of the cave at the end of the month, they gave a press conference, and there were dozens of reporters from all across the country. There was also a newsreel crew that filmed their last day. With the typical 1930s newsreel with a very excited sounding announcer and them doing their
now they're coming out of the cave.
and this newsreel was shown in hundreds of movie theaters, maybe thousands across the country. And so Kleitman, from being this really obscure scientist who very few people had heard of, suddenly becomes a celebrity, and he becomes the face of modern sleep science and really brings it to public awareness in a way that it had never been before.
And he writes a book, which remains a classic volume, Sleep and Wakefulness. And that becomes like the book for decades.
Yeah. And so he comes out of the cave. He's a national celebrity, and also he's got a platform now. So he had been working for years on the first sleep science textbook, and he published it the year he came out of the cave. And this book might have ordinarily just sunk into oblivion, but people were, scientists were starting to get interested in sleep science. There had always been just a handful who were doing it, but Kleitman's, raised profile started getting more people interested in this book, which was this fantastically encyclopedic book of basically every experiment that had been done in sleep science, since the mid-19th century, and all sorts of information about how to set up these experiments, how other scientists had done it, how Kleitman himself had set up his experiments, what the major problems in the field were, what the mysteries were that needed to get solved, you know, and also the basic measurements that he had done, because he had spent, by 1938, he had spent more than a decade measuring everything that was measurable at that time about sleep, how often people rolled over in the middle of the night.
Yeah, every aspect. It was yeah, amazing. Yeah. He was a micromanager of sleep.
Yes. How your temperature changed, how your breathing changed, you know, the effects of caffeine and alcohol, all this really basic stuff. So the publication of this book really gave the field a basic textbook, which it had never had before, and that was a very important breakthrough.
Let's move up to Eugene Ossorinsky.
Yeah.
Now, we're talking about the 1950s. Mm-hmm. What was his relationship with Kleitman?
So Eugene Ossorinsky was a graduate student in physiology. He was a very interesting character in that he'd had a really rough life, and he'd come to academia by a very roundabout route. His father was both a sort of low-rent dentist in Brooklyn and a card sharp who had nightly pinochle games in their apartment. Ossorinsky's mother died when he was a kid, and he is stuck with his father, who was a terrible narcissist and abuser. And he wound up he was a brilliant young person, but he was really just wandering for years and years and years, and was in the army during World War II, and came home and had a GI Bill, and finally eventually decided, you know what, I'm going to do the thing that's always interested me most, which is study physiology. So he goes to the University of Chicago, and the only advisor available was Nathaniel Kleitman, who was the world's most respected sleep researcher. Now, Ossorinsky had no particular interest in sleep, but he needed an advisor. He needed, you know, to do grad work. And so he started studying under Kleitman, and the two of them really disliked each other.
Yeah, and, it's amazing.
Yeah, and Ossorinsky in particular, just Kleitman, Ossorinsky had a problem with father figures, and Kleitman was the patriarch of sleep science. So it was a sort of a doomed relationship, but Kleitman had wanted Ossorinsky to study something that he'd just gotten interested in, which was, it began with blinking. How often do people blink on their way to falling asleep? That led to studies of eye movements. And ultimately what this led to was the discovery of REM sleep, which everybody has heard of, rapid eye movement sleep. If you want to, I can give you sort of how this wound up. How
Ossorinsky started out, didn't he, with infants and noticing that infants had eye movement.
Yeah, that's it. So Kleitman first said, well, Ossorinsky, you need to do something for your PhD thesis. What do you want to do? Ossorinsky, having tried to study blinking, he said, well, what if we study the eyes of infants when they're falling asleep and see, you know, what their eyes do. He started doing that. He wasn't sure what he was looking for exactly, but he just thought if he looked long enough, he'd find something interesting. Sure enough, studying infants in their cribs, he did find that when they were sleeping, their eyes, you could see their eyes moving back and forth beneath the closed lids. And there was a period of about 20 minutes every hour where the eyes stopped moving. He thought, well, that's kind of interesting. It's a cyclical
thing.
You know, nobody has noticed really cyclical things in sleep particularly before, except for the depth of sleep. This is new territory. He wasn't sure what to make of it. When it came time to do his thesis, he said, well, how about if I study the eye movements of adults when they're sleeping and just see what happens if I watch them all night? Nobody had done that before.
Huge breakthrough. And the other thing is, he's using an EEG machine.
Yeah.
Now, I want to digress for a moment, okay? Because this is one of the most fascinating aspects, one of the many fascinating aspects in your book, is the evolution of the EEG machine. So at the time of Eugene Ossorinsky, what was an EEG machine like?
Okay, so we're talking about early 1950s.
Yeah.
And the EEG had been discovered in the 1920s. by a scientist, German scientist named Hans Berger, who was trying to research the origins of telepathy. He believed in psychic energy and mental telepathy because of an incident that had happened when he'd fallen off a horse and his sister had sort of sensed that something was wrong decades earlier. And he'd spent 30 years trying to figure out how to read people's brain waves, which he thought would be a key to figuring out how people did mental telepathy. What it turned out was he discovered the EEG machine. He really invented the EEG machine and gave doctors and scientists a way to measure brain waves in people that was related to actually very practical things like epilepsy.
Yeah.
Right. And so, but the EEG machine had, so by the 1930s, it was coming into widespread use in medical settings. But only a few scientists had even looked at what happens to your brain waves during sleep. And that was in the 1930s. Kleitman was among them. A handful of scientists who did some studies of what happened to your brain waves, and they found in a vague sort of way that your electrical activity in your brain goes through several different stages that seem to cycle through the night. But they had not really looked at it very carefully, and other things had come up, and they'd sort of lost interest by the end of the 1930s. So when Ossorynsky began trying to do his eye movement studies, he thought, you know what would be interesting is to find out not only what's happening with the eyes, but what's happening in people's brains during different kinds of eye movements during sleep. And so he had the idea of, he asked Kleitman, hey, where can I find an EEG machine? There happened to be one in the basement of their their lab building in the University of Chicago. Kleitman had it brought upstairs to the lab. And the first person that Ossorynsky looked at was his own son, Armand, who was 8 years old at the time. And when Ossorynsky hooked Armand up to this machine, which could measure not only brain waves, but also electrical impulses in your muscles, including your eyeballs. So he put electrodes on Armand's head to measure his brain waves and right next to his eyes to measure his eye movements. And what he found was that during the night, at particular periods, several times a night, Armand's eyes would start jerking back and forth as if he was watching a tennis game. And Ossorynsky said, huh, I wonder what's going on there. And when he looked at the brain waves, he saw that the brain waves looked like almost like somebody who was awake. But when Ossorynsky went out into the room where his son was lying and said, Armand didn't answer because Armand was asleep. So he's asleep, but his brain is doing something that looks like he's awake, and his eyes are jerking back and forth. What could this possibly mean? So Ossorynsky started doing these experiments on more and more people, not just Armand, but other students at the University of Chicago. And he found that when he woke people up, he just had a hunch, I wonder if they might be dreaming. And he woke them up and said, what's going on? And it almost invariably, the people said, I was having this intense dream. And they could describe it also much better than people can usually describe their dreams, because by the time we wake up in the morning, they're already beginning to vanish from our brain.
Right.
But they would he'd wake them up in the middle of the night, in the middle of these REM periods, and people would say, here's what I was dreaming. So this was, quite an amazing thing.
It's a huge breakthrough. I mean, yeah. It's something we take for granted today, that REM equals dreams.
Right. And at that point, nobody had really looked that carefully at what's happening in the eyes. Nobody had looked that carefully at what's happening in the brain. And the idea that this thing was happening, one of the first things it did was overturn the conventional idea of what dreams are, which Kleitman had been a leading advocate of this idea, which is that when you're asleep, your brain basically mostly shuts down. And the reason you have dreams is because you have physical sensations that your brain is too sleepy to interpret correctly. And so it kind of lazily makes up these weird stories. So if you go to bed and you're a little hungry, your brain interprets that in a way that makes up the story, and you have a dream about eating. very sensible, but completely wrong.
Well, yeah, okay, but I want to make sure we move on to a couple of the other people. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest is award-winning journalist Kenneth Miller. And we're continuing our conversation about his really fascinating history, Mapping the Darkness, the visionary scientist who unlocked the mysteries of sleep. What a huge breakthrough for Ossorinsky. Now comes William Dement. Now, when did he come on the scene?
So, late 1952, Ossorinsky is gathering information about REM sleep. He's not sure what to make of it, but he's starting to realize it's really interesting. Kleitman, his mentor, says, "Hey, this looks like you're making progress here. I'm going to give you a lab assistant." And he also gives him a better EEG machine, which helps with the measurements. But more importantly, I think historically, he sends this young medical student named William Dement to help Ossorinsky in the lab. Dement was a kid from Walla Walla, Washington. Grew up in a farm town, was kind of a bohemian. He played jazz bass. He was a big believer in the teachings of Sigmund Freud. He was a Freudian. He was a medical student, but he wanted to become a Freudian psychoanalyst. And he believed, along with Freud, that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. And so he went to a lecture by Kleitman, and he was utterly transfixed by this news of this new phenomenon, REM sleep. And he went up to Kleitman after the lecture and said, "Hey, could I help you in some way? Can I work in your lab?" Kleitman said, yeah, you can go help Eugene Ossorinsky in the lab. So Dement starts helping Ossorinsky in the lab. 1953, Ossorinsky with Kleitman publishes their first paper on REM sleep. No, it doesn't really get a lot of notice. But shortly, right around the time the paper is published, Ossorinsky finally gets completely fed up with working with Kleitman.
Well, doesn't Kleitman accuse Ossorinsky of colluding with patients?
Well, Kleitman was a very careful scientist. And so he starts seeing this REM phenomenon that Ossorinsky is reporting, and he wants to make sure it's real. And he thinks, it is possible that Ossorinsky, who really needs to make a breakthrough and wants to, be a success, he could be making this stuff up. And so Kleitman sends, as an experimental subject, he says, "I want you to measure REM on my daughter." So he sends his daughter down. Ossorinsky is like, "Why is that?" Kleitman then later went down himself and said, "I want you to try it out on me." And for some reason, when Ossorinsky tried to measure REM in Kleitman, he really couldn't find it very well. So, Kleitman was he had an air of skepticism about him. He was kind of brusque. Ossorinsky, because of his own family background, interpreted this as hostility and meanness.
Okay.
And so Ossorinsky, right at the time his paper was published in 1953, he said, "I've had it. I'm leaving this lab. I'm leaving sleep research. I'm not really interested in this at all." He went off and studied something else entirely in neurology. Electrophysiology of the brain, basically, left the lab. And Dement, who had been getting more and more interested in this while helping out Ossorinsky, took over the REM research. And so Dement had a reason to actually be extremely excited about this because of his Freudian interests. And also, Dement was a very gregarious. He was really gifted in connecting with people. And he was able to connect with Kleitman. Kleitman was able to connect with Dement, and they had this almost father-son-like bond. And that allowed Dement to really dive into REM research and bring it to public attention and explore it in a way that Ossorinsky hadn't done, that Kleitman on his own would never have done.
The things that Dement found out were really fascinating. One of the things that happened was that he did these tests on schizophrenic patients. And he expected to find all sorts of changes in REM onset and stuff like that. And he didn't, did he?
No, he did not. And so Dement is a great illustration of how scientists can start out with a completely false hypothesis, and it brings them great, great breakthroughs and scientific riches. So Dement believed, Freud had a little-known theory that dreams are a safety valve for forbidden desires and impulses.
Right.
That if they burst into, we keep them suppressed during the day so that we don't act crazy. And if they burst, if they weren't let loose somehow, they might burst into consciousness as psychosis. And so Freud's idea was maybe things like schizophrenia are like somehow your dreams are breaking through into reality because of something that's happening at night. So Dement thought this was absolutely fascinating. He thought that probably if he tested dreams in people in a mental institution, schizophrenics, he would find that their dreams, that they weren't having normal REM sleep. And he went to a local state hospital near the University of Chicago and spent months doing EEG readings of schizophrenic patients, and found that other than the fact that their dreams actually were less interesting than those people's, they were sort of that nothing unusual was happening to their brain waves. This was very frustrating for him. He soon after that, he turned to the idea of, well, okay, what would happen if we deprived people of REM sleep? If every time they went into REM, we just kind of nudged them and woke them up, would they eventually start exhibiting psychotic symptoms? And he tried this. He actually did this for 20 years, trying it first on people and then on cats to see if he deprived people of REM sleep, would they go crazy? They did not. They got a little, sometimes they got a little paranoid. They certainly got irritable. One thing that he found happened was that they sometimes had increases in appetite and sort of impulsiveness and things like that, but they did not become psychotic. But what happened to Dement was, in studying all this stuff, he did such close studies of what happened to people's brains and bodies during sleep that he began to gain insights into things like narcolepsy.
Right.
He found that when he tested narcoleptic patients, they fell into REM sleep often almost immediately upon falling asleep. This was something very new because he'd never seen babies could fall into REM sleep immediately, and they spend half their sleeping time in REM, indicating that REM has something to do with neurodevelopment. But for adults, it typically takes 60 to 90 minutes to fall into REM sleep. But for people with narcolepsy, which is a disease in which you have sleeping spells during the day that you can't control, and often and your nighttime sleep is very disturbed, and also sometimes for most people who have narcolepsy, they have these terrible bouts of temporary paralysis, where if they have a strong emotion or laughter, they lose control over their muscles and can just collapse, basically, to a greater or lesser degree, that people with this disorder tended to fall into REM sleep right away. And when they were having a sleep attack during the day, they also immediately fell into something that looked a lot like REM. He started thinking, gosh, there's like all this sort of physiological stuff happening during sleep. What Dement finally, by 1970, he realized that sleep disorders were real physiological disorders, and that if you observe them carefully, you could learn to treat these things in a way that had never been done before.
It's amazing. He ended up authoring four papers with Kleitman. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the most important one was the fourth paper, Cyclic Variation in EEG During Sleep and Their Relations to Eye Movements, Body Motility, and Dreaming, was written in 1957. And that's where it was laid out that there were four stages of sleep. And it was a sort of monumental, groundbreaking paper.
Yes. And so part of the thing was that Dement really discovered that sleep is a structured activity, and that we are programmed, our brains are programmed to do it in a certain way, and that everybody he tested more or less had the same, what he broke into four sleep stages of increasing depth, So you would go from shallow stage one sleep to slightly deeper stage two to even deeper stage three to very deep stage four when you had what's called slow wave sleep, which is when your brain just is these slow, loopy rhythms. and then once you've been in that for a little while, you suddenly bob right back up to stage one. And at that point is when REM sleep begins.
One of the other things that DeMent did, too, is also encouraged using female patients or subjects for his experiments. That had not been done before. And it's amazing that it needs to be mentioned, but all the previous experiments had been done on male subjects.
Yes. And this is, I think, one of the places where you see this interesting intersection of science and social forces, right? So, you know, part of what was happening in science in the early 1950s was it was just like everything else in the early 1950s. It was male, absolutely male dominated. And the idea was that women were sort of this second, sort of second class citizens in so
many
different ways.
We don't really need to study them.
Yeah, we don't really need to study them. But DeMent was a nonconformist. And DeMent was actually sort of he had sort of pro-feminist impulses. And he had a girlfriend who he thought was really smart, and he brought her in to be
the first. Yeah, he's of all the major scientists in this book, he's the one I was most interested in. But Mary was the other one. We're going to run out of time because I had planned to talk to you about you actually meeting one of the giants of sleep research. Pronounce her last name for me. I never get it right.
Mary Karskaden. And Mary Karskaden came to work as DeMent's lab assistant in 1970.
We have to stop.
Opened his clinic.
We actually have to stop there, which is too bad. People are going to need to get this book to see the great. There's a great ending for this book where you meet one of the giants of sleep research. My returning guest tonight is award-winning journalist Kenneth Miller. And we're continuing our conversation about his book, Mapping the Darkness, The Visionary Scientist Who Unlocked the Mysteries of Sleep. Ken, it's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me again.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.